So to briefly catch everybody up, we are studying the United Kingdom, and we are in 1 Samuel 18 through, I think it's 20-something, 22. We're going to be picking up middle of the way in this. We're going to be talking about David and Jonathan's covenant and kind of moving through Lesson 7, moving into Lesson 8. We've just talked about David and Goliath, and what David has gone through, and kind of the contrasting David versus Saul, and how David was a very godly young man, how Saul was not a man of courage or not a man of faith. Towards the end of last class, we also discussed different ways that Saul was against David. We're entering a point where Saul is continually pursuing David. He is wanting ill will towards David, and we looked at several verses that talked about what Saul was trying to do to pursue David, to put him to death, to cause adverse will or effect to him, that sort of thing. Before we continue on, though, I'd ask if you would bow with me. We'll have a word of prayer, and then we'll continue with class. Almighty God, we're thankful for an opportunity to come before your throne and to meet midweek, Father, to study your word and to worship you, Father. Father, we're thankful for those who are here this evening who have chosen to take time out of their lives to assemble to not only study your word, but to edify one another, to encourage and uplift, to hold accountable and to strengthen, Father, their fellow brethren, to support this local work. As we go about this evening, Father, we ask that you help us to set aside our cares and concern for this world and to open the inspired word and to try to glean something from the context we are studying this evening. Help us to understand, Father, that you are a God who keeps his word, keeps his covenants. But, Father, you are a jealous God. You would have no other before you. Help us to recognize that in our daily lives, that you will hold true to your word, Father. But we must be obedient to you and recognize that you are the only one true and living God. Whereas in the olden times, Father, there were those who would put other gods above you, worship other gods. Father, we tend to idolize material things. We tend to idolize material wealth, possessions, power. Father, help us to recognize that we should be servants of yours, not living for the wealth of this life, but for living for the riches we can have in heaven. Father, we want to thank you for your Son and our Savior, Jesus Christ, who was willing to die on the cross for the remission of our sins. We're thankful that he is our high priest, that he is our mediator, and it's through his atoning blood that we can come to you now. Amen. So, Saul is after David, kind of where we left off, and I read Psalms 59, the entirety of Psalms 59. Probably if you listen to the recording, you need to slow it down a little bit because I was getting it to finish up the end of class. But I wanted to go back because we've talked about how Saul is pursuing David, but I felt like when reading Psalms 59, or what I wanted to make an impact on y'all was David's mindset. And it's kind of twofold, or what I would suggest is twofold. So I'm going to read the first four verses of Psalms 59. So at the top of this, this says, this is a Psalm of David, when Saul sent men and they watched his house in order to kill him. So this was when he sent the messengers to his door and Michael let him out and he left. But verse 1 of Psalms 59 says, deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Set me securely on high away from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who do iniquity and save me from men of bloodshed. For behold, they have set an ambush for my life. Fierce men launch an attack against me, not for my transgression nor for my sin, O Lord. For no guilt of mine, they run and set themselves against me. Arouse yourself to help me and see. David was a man of strong faith and courage. But just because you have faith and courage doesn't mean you're not going to be afraid at times. There are men out to get David. He shows strength and courage in what he's doing, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to be afraid. And there are men at his door who are wanting to kill him. Saul continually pursues him, tries to set himself against him. We know that God's with us, and this is an application we can make in our lives. We know that we're going to face difficulties. We're going to face different types of troubles and trials. We can have faith. It's okay to be afraid, but we need to also make sure that we persevere and have courage in what God has told us he would do for us. That doesn't mean blessings in this life, but it does mean eternal rewards if we're willing to be obedient to him. David was scared, but he had courage, and he put his faith in God that things would work out. flipping back over to 1 Samuel chapter 20. David has fled. And in chapter 20, verse 1, it says, "Then David fled from Noah in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?' He said to him, 'Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, "Do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." We can see that in Psalms 59, that he has faith in God, but he's scared. I'm a foot away. I'm just a step away. Saul's nipping at my heels, trying to kill me. He knows that he's the Lord's anointed. He knows that the Lord is with him, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't have someone pursuing him. He doesn't necessarily know what's going to happen next. And so he's asking these questions, and put yourself in David's shoes. What have I done? He's been anointed. He killed the Philistine. He's done everything that Saul's asked him. I mean, Saul, if he was a good king, had no reason to be after David. David had done nothing but what the Lord had asked of him and helped to further the kingdom. But, you know, David here is asking, what have I done? He's scared because he hadn't even done anything wrong. He hadn't done anything to slight Saul. Jump down to verse 12. So it talks here that David talks to Jonathan, and Jonathan said, David asked him to talk to his dad, and then they jump down to verse 12, and it says, "Then Jonathan said to David, 'The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there is good feeling toward David, shall I not then send you and make it known to you? If it please my father, do to you harm. If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also. If I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, and may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I'm still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever. Not even the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth.' So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, 'May the Lord require it as the hands of David's enemies.' Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life." That's the covenant between Jonathan and David. David asked Jonathan to talk to his dad and to feel him out. And Jonathan said he would feel him out and then I'll get back with you. But he makes this covenant with David and says that he would warn him. He would let him know. But he wants David to make a covenant with him that you're not going to be against my house. He says, verse 14, "If I'm still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever." He's talking about not just them, but their houses as it comes. Now, I asked a question, and we will not beleaguer this point because it is subjective, but I think it's important because it's expressed throughout several scriptures. Why do you believe Jonathan and David had such a close relationship? And I'll preface this by, you think about it. Jonathan's of the house of Saul. David is the new anointed. David's not of his house. He just comes in. Saul takes him, puts him in his house. He's going to take the kingdom away from him. Saul expresses that later. David is basically there to take the throne from what would be Jonathan if Saul were to die. David's held in a higher esteem. He continually prospers because of God. He continually finds favor with the people and the servants. Everything seems to be going his way. And I know that you can look in the world today and you can look at somebody and people can grow envious. Like everything just seems to be going right with them. And I want what they have. I mean, or it makes you sick. I just can't believe that everything seems to go right. Everything they touch turns to gold. Everything, you know, just people get that kind of mindset. They can get eat up with envy. So there's that as well. I mean, and then it's, you know, maybe it's a little bit weird that they were close because of an age difference. They're not really contemporaries. Jonathan's senior to David if you know, the chronology plays out. So my question is, why do you believe that Jonathan and David had such a close relationship?
Well, Jonathan, it seems like Jonathan was a very godly man, very unlike his father. He realized that David wasn't the anointed. You know, that was God's decision. Maybe godly men became good friends.
I agree. I completely agree, and I think that's the conclusion you can draw from the text. You see, in 18:1, it says that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and they loved him as himself. And in chapter 19:1, it says Jonathan greatly delighted in David. In 20:17, it says because of his love for him, because he loved him also loved him as his own life. You know, they have this close relationship. In 2 Samuel 1:26, when David's lamenting the death of Jonathan, he mentions, "You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women." Now, I don't know the age difference, and we're not going to get down bogged into the weeds. I sent an email out, and there's a bunch of ifs and capitals. If their age difference was greater, this would even be more interesting, but that's really of no consequence. It's interesting to me that Jonathan would choose David over Saul, but I think John is completely right. You see in chapter 14 that Jonathan expresses the idea when he's getting ready to attack the Philistines that the Lord is not restrained to save me by many or by few. Jonathan put his faith in the Lord, knew that the Lord would prevail regardless of whether it was by few or by many. In 19:5, the Lord brought out a great deliverance for all Israel. In 2013, in the context we're just reading, if it pleased my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also if I do not make it known to you and send you away. The idea is that he didn't want that to happen to David, being the Lord's anointed. And in chapter 23:17, I'll flip over there just a couple pages over. In 23:17, Jonathan understands what's going on. In 23:17, this is Jonathan coming to encourage David. He says, "Thus he said to him, 'Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also.'" This is Jonathan's hope, but he understands that David is the anointed one. I believe that Jonathan and David's relationship was close because, like John said, he was a man of God. And you don't know the impact that Jonathan had. This is just all, you know, conjecture. But you don't know what kind of impact that Jonathan had in the time that he was in Saul's kingdom. He was loyal to his king because he was supposed to. But he had trust in God, and he was obedient to God as well. And you see that, you know, he had an influence or an impact on his dad in certain situations. How much worse would the nation have been if Jonathan not been there? And then you see what kind of an impact Jonathan had as you move through time as he affects David's life. And so, it's interesting to me, but to me, Jonathan's an unsung hero in a sense. It seems that in chapter 18, he kind of takes David under his wing. Their souls were knit together. Maybe he finds somebody who is either his same age or who he's older than that he has something in common with. We're under a wicked king, but here's someone who is God's anointed, who's striving to do God's will, who's willing to stand up, and that's what he's been trying to do too. And so maybe I can shield him from my father, who is a wicked man, who he's been living under, and I can help him. I can be a confidant to him. It's just interesting to me that because Jonathan continually puts himself in harm's way for David. And I think that Jonathan, we can see that Jonathan's faith is very great. And I think that's why he helps David out. I mean, is it of any consequence in our story? It does affect it from the standpoint of he continually helps David out in this situation. It'll continue on as David saves Mephibosheth later on in this, but it's just interesting to me that Jonathan would stick his neck out in that way for David. But that being said, let's move on. It says, my next question is, the Lord is with David. Does that mean David's perfect? So I glossed over something, but that's the purpose. So I wanted you all to answer this question. Is David perfect? Give me an example in this text to why he is or isn't. I see a bunch of no's. Y'all can answer. He's not perfect, but how can you show in this text that David is not perfect?
He told Jonathan to lie.
He told Jonathan to lie. You know, I don't know what's all going on. And there we've got that I don't know bucket over here. So I don't know. There's a lot of I don't knows. What David could have done different. But did he have to ask Jonathan to lie for him? No. Is David perfect? No. Do we know David's a godly man? Yes. We do know that as Christians that we will fall short of God's glory, that we will sin. But what's different from the sin of Saul
and the sins of David is that David strived to do God's will. And he may have stumbled from time to time, but we can look to the Psalms and see his penitence over and over again. Whereas Saul became self-serving, selfish, and not looking for penitence. He was looking for self-satisfaction. He was looking for pride. He was looking for notoriety. David's not perfect, but we do know him as a man after God's own heart. And so as we go through, and as I've talked about wanting to compare him to Saul, we can see it's his character. And we can emulate ourselves after that from the standpoint of we shouldn't try to sin, but we also need to understand that at times in our life we will. But if we rededicate ourselves to God and we are willing to ask for that forgiveness and continue on, that God will forgive us. Nobody's perfect. But David is a good case study for having a love for God and wanting to do His will. What is Saul's reasoning for putting David to death in this context? So the kingdom wouldn't go to Jonathan. That was something I mentioned earlier. You know, Jonathan was going to be upset. I mean, he's taken this nation away from him, essentially. And that didn't matter to Jonathan because he was a man of God. But the question is this an act of futility? Saul's angry about this, but is there anything that he can do to stop it? No. God's will be done. And it's funny that Eli, when we talked about him, Eli was kind of resigned to the fate of his sons and resigned to the fate of what was going to happen. Saul just continually clings to this idea that maybe he can change things. And you can see he becomes more self-serving, more selfish as we continue through this context. So no, there's nothing he could do. All right, moving on to 1 Samuel 21 and 22. So I'm going to try to move quick because I'm a little behind. So moving into 1 Samuel 21 and 22, they go together. So David, please. Yes, sir.
Son and daughter both lying to him, you know, about where David is to say, you got Michal or Michael and now Jonathan being willing to lie to Saul to protect David. It speaks towards Saul's character that because of his wicked ways, he loses that relationship, that trusting relationship with his kids by having this.
They were willing to protect David. Nobody condones the lies that they told, but it does in a sense indict Saul for his attitude and his actions against David. Yes. I didn't put that together, but them being siblings and that being the case. So moving into chapter 21, so David flees. Jonathan and David reaffirm their covenant in verse 42, and then David leaves and he goes to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. And here he stumbles. How does he stumble in this context? He lies about where he's going. He lies, and again, there's this I don't know. Why did David lie? We just talked about his courage and his faith, but then he's going to lie to the priest. He's going to have Jonathan lie to Saul. I don't know why he did those things. It is out of character for him in the sense that he's wanting to do God's will, but you know, sometimes in dire circumstances, we tend to make poor choices. And I don't know if that's not an excuse for him, but it may be the situation going on. We should be aware of that sometimes we're going to have to take the consequences of our actions, or we're going to have to deal with what's going on, but we should be conscious of always trying to serve God. But he lies. So he goes to Ahimelech, and he says he's on a secret mission, and so he gathers provisions. While he's there, who saw David with Ahimelech? Doeg the Edomite. He was I don't know what they call him, a worthless man. Maybe in the next chapter. But Doeg sees him. While David's there, he gets consecrated bread. He goes and he gets the sword of Goliath, and then he leaves. From there, he's on the run. So not sure his age range at this time, but he's anywhere from, you know, 15 to 20, 25, and he's on his own. He's running. He's got the king of an entire nation pursuing him and all his followers. He's got Jonathan in his corner. It seems that his wife is in his corner, but not a whole lot else going for him. And so he flees to Gath. Did he find people there willing to open them and take him in as a sanctuary? No. He shows up in Gath and the king tells him, the king's servants tell him, is this not the David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this, the one that dances, saying, Saul has slain thousands, did David slain 10,000? David took those words to heart and greatly feared the king of Gath. And so what did he do? He acted insane. It says that he disguised his sanity. He acted insane. He scribbled on doors. He let his saliva run down his beard. And they called him a madman. And so he was able to escape. And so he escapes and he continues to flee. He flees to Moab. And what happens in Moab before he moves on to Judah? He picks up a band of men. If you look in verse 2, he's traveled into Moab, and it says, everyone who is distressed, who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. David's no longer alone. He's roaming the wilderness. He's fleeing from Saul, but he's no longer alone. He's gained some men. But do they seem to be godly men? Seem to be desperate men. But they're men who have bound themselves to David. And so from Moab, David is then told he needs to go on to the land of Judah. And so he moves that direction. And it says he departed and he went into the forest of Herath. And that's in verse 5. Now Saul hears about this and Saul gets upset. And he starts raving about, nobody wants to talk to me about where David is. And who speaks up in this context? Doeg. Doeg is this worthless man. And in verse 9 it says, of chapter 22, then Doeg the Edomite was standing by the servants of Saul and said, I saw the son of Jesse come to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. And so Saul summons Ahimelech to him. So here are the accusations. Verse 12, it says, Saul said, listen now, son of Ahitub. And he answered him, here I am, my lord. Saul then said to him, why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you gave him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he would rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day? How did Ahimelech answer Saul's accusations? He reminded him what?
He reminded him of David's loyalty to him.
I mean, first off, he says, and who among all your servants is faithful as David? You know, so David is the most faithful. He makes it sound like even the king's son-in-law, who is captain of your guards and is honored in your house. Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Indications are that he's been coming to Ahimelech more than once to inquire of God. It's not a one and done thing. This is a regular occurrence. Now, again, is Ahimelech aware of what's going on? No. David's told him he's on a secret mission. So Ahimelech is not only going, well, David inquires of me, at least he has inquired of me. I don't know if it was on a regular basis or not, but he has inquired of me. But, you know, is he not a faithful man? Am I not supposed to inquire of him? Am I not supposed to help him? He's completely unaware of what's going on. He continues on in 15 and says, do not let the king impute anything to his servant or anything of the house of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this whole affair. But the king said, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, and you and all your father's household. Saul's willing to put him to death. Is Saul thinking straight? And that's a loaded question, I guess. He's of sound mind. He's not insane. He knows what he's doing. But he's let this evil creep in. He's allowing himself, his rage, his vengeance, whatever, he's allowing that to creep in and to make a decision. All because of selfishness and pride. He doesn't want David to take the kingdom. He wants to put him to death. He doesn't like that David's been exalted over him. And so here he's going to put to death a priest in his household. All right, verse 17. And then the king said to the guards who were attending to him, turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death, because they're hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me. But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands and attack the priests of the Lord. The servants knew. Servants knew how faithful David was. Knew that the priest had done nothing wrong. Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn around and attack the priest." And Doeg the Edomite turned and attacked the priest, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. And he struck Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of his sword, both men and women, children and infants, as oxen, donkeys, and sheep. He struck with the edge of the sword. And so as we end up at the end of chapter 22, what I wanted to point out, because we've gone through that kind of quick, is that Saul's going to pursue to David to whatever end he desires. Whether it be priests he's going to kill, whether he's got to step over somebody else, he'll use whatever means necessary. He's going to find David. And he's going to do it because of his pride, because of his jealousy. Let's move into lesson number 8. So the context of the United Kingdom, as we look at David and Saul, I wanted to focus on, you know, the story behind them and how that plays out. You know, there are things that we've glossed over. Some of that is just for time's sake. Some of it's conjecture. But as we look at it, it's interesting to see the back and forth, how Saul becomes more and more, I don't want to say depraved, but how he becomes more and more godless. How David continually clings to God in these times of trouble and trial. And you see this, you know, this compare and contrast on them, this contrast of the men in their lives as you move forward. So to that end, in lesson number 8, in this first context, I asked, what did David do when he found out the Philistines were plundering Keilah? And let's put this into context. So David is in Judah. All right, he's fleeing from Saul. He's got 400 men who we don't know that they're godly men. It looks like they're not from the standpoint of how they're described. He's on the run from the king of a nation and his army behind him. But then he hears that there's fighting and plundering. And what does David do? He inquires of God. I may be on the run, but there are things happening to these people here, and I'm going to inquire of God of what he would have me to do. And so he inquires of God, and God says, go and attack the Philistines and deliver Keilah. But then in verse 3 it says, but David's men said to him, behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah and against the ranks of the Philistines? Are we just not inviting more and more trouble on ourselves? Not only are we being sought, but now we're going to go with 400 men, we're going to go and fight the band, a band or raiders of the Philistines. I mean, we're already on the ropes in the sins, and now we're going to go and seek out trouble. So when the men say they're afraid, what does David do? He inquires again. You continually see that David's putting his faith in God. He's going to put his faith in God and do what he wills, because he understands that God will take care of him. Again, now we've talked about this. This still takes faith and courage. Because he is on the run. He's on the ropes. He's in the wilderness. Doesn't have a lot of supplies. He's facing a great people. It's going to take courage to go up against them. But he does. So, is there a difference between what... is this different than what Saul did in the verses that I gave you? It is. I mean, Saul just does what he wants. He kind of goes off half-cocked and decides what he wants to do. And then we see in times, you know, eventually he'll get around to maybe asking God or sacrificing to God or inquiring of God, and God doesn't listen because he's not wanting to do what God's will is. David, on the other hand, being a man of God, continually inquires of God what you would have me to do. So he goes and he fights. And then when Saul's coming to besiege him, so he hears that David has gone to Keilah and he's fighting. When Saul came to besiege David, what does he do? Well, no, he's already gone to war. Now Saul's coming to besiege him. So Saul's coming to besiege him. What does he do? He inquires of God again. He inquires of the Lord. And the Lord tells him that the men of Keilah will give him up. And so he leaves. But David, that's what his focus is. What does God want me to do? Continually does that. He looks to God for his answers for what he would have him to do so he could do God's will. And we see in verse 14, David stayed in the wilderness in the stronghold. So he fled and he remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. David continually inquires of God, and God's looking out for him. So Saul's pursuing David. David meets up with Jonathan again, and Jonathan encourages him. And then again, we see in verse 17 that Jonathan tells him, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you, and you will be king over Israel." Here's Jonathan encouraging David again, this man of God who has been there for him time and time again. And so Saul's pursuing him. He pursues him, and Jonathan's encouraged him. And you know, we talked about Saul nipping on his heels. Look at verse 26. Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize them. But a messenger came to Saul, saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land." So Saul returned from pursuing David and went to meet the Philistines. Therefore they called the place the Rock of Escape. And so David went up from there and stayed in the strongholds of En Gedi. Was that by happenstance that David wasn't caught? I'd say it's by the providence of God. Doesn't say that here, but Saul's continually pursuing, but convenient timing that Saul would have to go and fight the Philistines right when David's about to be captured. David could be captured. God would prevail, but it's Saul right there, constantly pursuing him. Moving into 1 Samuel 24. We see that Saul returns from pursuing the Philistines and he's after David again. Verse 4, it says, "The men of David..." So Saul came into the cave. And then so the men of David said to him... we'll start in verse 3. "And he came to this sheepfolds on the way, and where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave, and the men of David said to him, 'Behold this day, the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I'm about to give your enemy into your hand, and you should do to him as it seems good to you.' Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly." And I asked the question, I gave you that context. "Behold, I'm about to give your enemy to your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you." Is that true? That's what the men are telling David. Is that true? I hear yeses and noes. Yes, no, and give me your reasoning. It was a test? Explain that. We definitely see that afterward. It's a test. I mean, is it true that the Lord delivered him into his hand? It is. Is it true that David could have killed him? Could have. Would it have been a sanction by God? There's the rub. And I don't know how much time I've studied on this. And so I'll give you my thoughts and then I'll let you give your thoughts. So I don't think that David had the right to take Saul's life. We see his reasonings for that, that he's the Lord's anointed. But just in general, since this man's chasing him, he's chasing him through the wilderness, he's chasing him, trying to kill him, but he comes into the cave. If he wasn't the Lord's anointed, should David have killed him? He's a defenseless man. I don't think that's what the Lord would have wanted. And I'll set that over here with the pen for a second, because I'll come back to that in a little bit. But I want y'all to be thinking about that. So, Susan, you've already mentioned it, but why didn't David take Saul's life? Well, look at verse number 6. David's conscience was violent in verse 5, and it said in verse 6, "Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he's the Lord's anointed." So David had a crisis of conscience, that he even cut the robe of Saul. He cut the robe of Saul to let Saul know that he could have killed him, which to me means that David maybe contemplated it. I want to let you know how close I was and what I could have done to you. But then he has this crisis of conscience. "Far be it from me that I should do this thing." Slip down to verse 10. "Behold this day, your eyes have seen the Lord." He's talking to Saul, "and given you today into my hand in the cave. And some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed." Down in verse 12, "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you." Verse 15, "The Lord therefore be judge and decide between you and me, and may he see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." David said, "You're the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to raise my hand to you." He had raised his hand to him. He did cut his robe. Was his intent to kill him at that time? I think his intent was to show that he could have. We'll see maybe a change of thought process and a change of mindset as we move through these passages. But David said he wasn't going to take his life because he was the Lord's anointed. It wasn't for him to do so. It was for the Lord to avenge him. It was for the Lord to judge him. And so we see here that David had opportunity, but he didn't take it because he was concerned. We see that he had a crisis of conscience and he didn't want to be disobedient to God or to hurt his conscience. And he made Saul aware of it, that I could have. Again, I could have done this to you, but I chose not to. The Lord wouldn't want me to, and I'll let the Lord judge between the two of us. Continually thinking about what the Lord wants, not what he wants. I'm not going to get through this. As we move into chapter 25, verse 1, and just this will just be a note, Samuel's passed away. It says in verse 1, "Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned him and buried him at the house in Ramah." When we move into chapter 25, starting in verse 2, the story of Nabal and Abigail. So we know this story fairly well, so I'm just going to have you answer these questions. What did Nabal say or do that angered David?
Wouldn't help his men,
wouldn't give him food. Look at verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David?" He wouldn't help him, but it's also the slight that he slides in here. "Who is this son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered from my shears and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" It's like, there's a bunch of people breaking off from the kingdom. Am I going to give my stuff to these people that I really don't know anything about? Does he really not know who David is? Does he not know what David's been doing? Does he not know that David's God's anointed? He's a selfish man. He's a prideful man. I don't want to say covetous, but he wants everything for himself. We know this because we can see that Abigail knows. She's with him. She knows who David is, but it's excuses. "I don't want to have to help him. I'm not going to do that." All right, so David's men go back and report to him. And so David is not very happy. And so in verse 13, he says, "Each you gird up his sword." So each man girded his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the bag, and he was going to go, and he was going to kill Nabal. What was reported to Abigail? Reviled the men? Yes. All right. So she's told that David sent messengers and they were scorned. So mine says scorned, not reviled, but that's a good word. And the report was from their men was that they were good to us. They were good to us. They didn't insult us. They didn't take anything from us. They were a wall to us both night and day. But evil has been plotted against our master and all his household. And so they come and report this to Abigail. And so, what does Abigail do?
She goes to David
and she pleads with him. She brings him stuff. She apologizes for Nabal. I ask the question, what kind of woman is Abigail based on this passage?
Wise and understanding.
Ma'am?
Honorable.
Woman of faith, that was my number one, woman of faith for sure. Prudent, diplomatic. I mean, what was it, what else?
Righteous.
I think about the way in which she went to David as well. So here you have the Lord's anointed. She knows who he is. He is a man on an island. He's got his guys. He's upset with her husband. And she goes and she's very humble, and she's very, diplomatic in the way she speaks and the way she phrases things. And I find it very interesting what she points out to him, because not only is she going to try to calm David down, but she also points something out to him in a very passive would be the right word, but a very even killed way. Verse 26, now therefore, my Lord, and this is, imagine her standing there talking, you know, she says in verse 25, please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man Nabal. But now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself on your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek evil against the Lord be as Nabal. My Lord, please, you know, my husband's a worthless man, and don't let yourself get caught up in this, and I'm glad that the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and avenging yourself. Let me kind of come in the back door and show you that, look what you're doing. All you're doing is you're avenging yourself. This isn't of the Lord. Go to verse 30. And when the Lord does this, for my Lord, according to all that is good, she's talking about, back to verse 29. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. For the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord does for my Lord, according to all that good he has spoken concerning you, and appoints you ruler over Israel, this will not cause you grief or trouble to my Lord, by both having shed blood without cause, and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord deals well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. Lord, I understand he's a worthless man, he has slighted you, but I'm glad that the Lord has restrained you. But just see, Father, Lord, that, you know, this is, you know, you're avenging yourself, and I don't want you to have problems later on down the line. Very diplomatic, you know, very, very, not pointing out, look, you're sinning, you're making a bad choice, but very diplomatic way of, and a way to diffuse the situation. Abigail is a very wise, very faithful, very righteous woman. And she, I felt like, handled this situation very well. So, what happened to Nabal at the end of this story? What does it say exactly about him?
He turned to stone.
He was turned to stone. It says verse 37. So he has this party. He was merry. He gets very drunk. And so she didn't tell him what happened until the next morning. But in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, so that he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. The Lord judged him. He put him to death. Nabal got what he deserved, being a worthless man. And so, David takes Abigail and he marries her. Now, we're a couple minutes from being through, so I do want to point something out, because we'll pick it up. The thread that I wanted to, as I group these lessons together, these passages together. It's interesting to me, as you look at 1 Samuel 24, that David did arise and cut off Saul's robe secretly. And it said it came out about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. And then he goes and gives his explanation. Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord and the Lord's anointed. It's not for him to do that. You go over here and you see that Abigail's pointing out to him that by attacking Nabal, that he's avenging himself. That he's going to avenge himself. And then, you know, it says in verse 30 that the Lord does for my Lord according to, verse 31, that this will not cause grief or trouble in your heart to my Lord, by both having shed blood without cause, and by my Lord having avenged himself. I want to think about those passages as we move into the next time that David spares Saul. To me, there's a mindset that's involved as he goes to spare Saul again. I will point that out as we get into the next class. So kind of like a cliffhanger, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to continue that thought until next class. So that'll be it for us this evening. Lessons 9 and 10 in the back here shortly. So thank you for your attention this evening.